जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा जन बल्लवर धारी गौती जन गौती जन बल्लवर धारी गौती जन शौर नंदन गज जन वंदना शौर नंदन गज जन वंदना शौर नंदन जनधीरा वनचारी जन्मधीरा वनचारी माधव कुंज बिहारी राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जन बल्लभा गिरिधर धारी गोपी जन बल्लभा गिरिधर धारी शौरनंदन गज जन रंजन शौरनंदन गज जन रंजन शौरनंदन जमीन पीरा नीरा जमीन पीरा
ज कौचर सतसी श्रीमारी श्री भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय इसकॉन फाउंडर आचार्य श्री प्रभुपाद की जय जय विष्णु का परमहंस परिवाज काचार्य स्टौतर सतसी श्रीमा भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर की जय अनंत कल्ति वैष्णव वृंद की जय नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री दैत राधा श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद की जाए श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गो गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंद राधा कुंद गिरी गोवर्धन की जाय वृंदावन की जाय मायापुर धाम की जाय जगन्नाथ स्वामी की जाय गंगा मई की जाय यमुना मई की जाय तुलसी देवी की जाय भक्ति देवी की जाय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जाय ऑल ग्लोरीज ऑफ द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज गौर प्रेमानंदी हरि हरि बोल There it is. So, Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 9. Mother Yashoda binds Lord Krishna. This is, again, Canto 10, Chapter 9, Text 10. So, Anvanchamana. Oh, whoops. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Anvanchamanam Janani Brihat Chalat Chani Bharam Akrantam Gati Sumadhyamam Javainam Visransitam Kesham Vandanam Chitam Pasunam Anigati Paramrishat. Anvanchamana janani brihachalat. Anvanchamana janani brihachalat. Chori bharakranta gatik sumadhyamam. Chori bharakranta gatik sumadhyamam. Javainari sansita kesha vandanam. Javainari sansita kesha vandanam. Chita prasunana gati paramrishat. Chita prasunana gati paramrishat. Anvanchamana janani bihachalat. Chauri bharakranta gati sumadhyamam. Javainari sansita kesha vandana. Chuta prasunana gati paramrishat.
Ladies,
So, Prabhupada's translation, Anvanshamana means following Krishna very swiftly. Janani, Mother Jashoda, Brihat Chalat Shoni, Bhara Akranta Gati. Being overburdened by the weight of her large breast, she became tired and had to reduce her speed. Sumadhyama, because of her thin waist, Javena, because of going very fast, Visang Sita Kesha Vandana, from her arrangement of hair which had become loosened, Chuta Prasuna Anugati. She was followed by the flowers following after her. Paramrishat finally captured Krishna without fail. This word Paramrishat, that she captured Krishna, of course, the same word we find in the Damodar prayers, at the end of the first verse, Paramrishtam. Paramrishtam, and here the word that Krishna was captured. So Prabhupada's translation, while following Krishna, Mother Jashoda, her thin waist overburdened by her heavy breasts, naturally had to reduce her speed. Because of following Krishna very swiftly, her hair became loose, and the flowers in her hair were falling after her. Yet she did not fail to capture her son Krishna. Prabhupada's purport. Yogis cannot capture Krishna by severe penances and austerities, but Mother Jashoda, despite all obstacles, was finally able to catch Krishna without difficulty. This is the difference between a yogi and a bhakta. Yogis cannot enter even Krishna's effulgence. Yasya prabha prabhavato jagaranda koti kotishu, Brahma Sanghita 540. In that effulgence there are millions of universes, but yogis and jnanis cannot enter that effulgence even after many, many years of austerities, whereas bhaktas can capture Krishna simply by love and affection. This is the example shown here by Mother Jashoda. Krishna therefore confirms that if one wants to capture him, one must undertake devotional service. Bhaktya mam abhijanati javan jaschasmi tatvataha tatomam tatvato gyatva bishate taranantaram. Bhaktas enter even the planet of Krishna very easily, but the less intelligent yogis and jnanis, by their meditation, remain running after Krishna. Even if they enter Krishna's effulgence, they fall down. Arucha krichena parang padang tatak patantiyadhan. Prabhupada ki jai. Om Vishnu padaya Krishna prishnaya bhutale simate bhakti vedanta swamini ki namine namaste sarasate deve gauravani pracharine nirvishesha sunyavari paschatya deshatayine. So, Anvanshavana Janani Brihat Chalat Shoni Bhara Kranta Gatik Sumadhyama Javena Visansita Kesha Vandana Chuta Prasunanu Gati Paramrasha. This is, of course, the famous story of Damodar Leela. And the point which Prabhupada makes in his purport is, of course, the point which is often made about this very instructive story, that we can only capture Krishna by devotion. As said in the Brahma Sanghita, Sudurlabham Adurlabha Atma Bhakto, that Krishna is very hard to achieve. It's very hard to achieve Krishna, and yet it's easy to attain Krishna by real devotion. So, this is the great equalizer. I mean, and it always has been historically, in the sense that materially, we are in different situations. Some people are young, like myself. Other people are older, like Brahmatirtha. There are men, there are women in the world, and as you may have noticed, people have different levels of education, of money. Some people have lots of friends. Some people are loners. People are in many different situations. Some people are happy. Some people are less happy. So, well, some people have successful marriages, some people have the marriage from hell. So, materially, we are all in very different situations. And yet, this is the great equalizer. Because these differences pertain to the body. And Krishna is really after our soul. It's us that Krishna wants. He wants us to turn to him. And so, as I sometimes say, everyone can have their Rudolph moment. You know, then one foggy Janmashtami Eve, Krishna came to say, probably with your, whatever, bhakti so bright, won't you lead, whatever, tonight. So, you know, the Rudolph story, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, is that, you know, the underdog prevails. And so the great opportunity of Krishna consciousness and Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, has always played this role historically, that no matter how oppressive a society may be, no matter how unequal people may be externally, that any person, it's absolutely irrelevant, one's gender, one's age, one's educational level, all that matters really is one's devotion. Because if Krishna chooses you, you know, if you have your Rudolph moment, and if Krishna chooses you and chooses to empower you, then you can do wonderful things in this world. And this is absolutely available to everyone. And another thing is the process of devotion, as Rupa Goswami explains in that tricky verse, Upadeshamrita, Niyamagraha, which can be divided in two ways. In Sanskrit, the short A means not, which we still have in English, by the way, in words like atheist or agnostic, which means agyani. So means not, but like when the doctor puts the ice cream stick in your mouth, means, it can mean very intensely. And so graha, of course, we still have in English also, graha as grasp, same word. So agraha means not grasping or not taking. And agraha means sort of like swallowing whole, like taking is everything. So the idea is, if we do not follow the principles of Krishna consciousness, our devotion will actually wane. And this is an interesting point, because you could say that following external principles is external. External merely in the sense that it involves observable behavior. Like, for example, getting up at a certain time. Well, observable, we don't have cameras in all your rooms, but it's behavior which in principle is observable. You get up at a certain time, or you chant rounds, or you go to this artik, or you follow certain principles. This is external in the sense it involves behavior performed directly with your body, and behavior which in principle is observable. And yet, and it's mechanical. It has its mechanical aspect in the sense that, you get up, it becomes a routine, it becomes a habit. So you get up at this time, or you go to the temple, you do this, or you do that. So, one can say, well, as I've heard people say, I heard people say this even years and years and years ago. I remember in 1972, I think it was, I heard a sannyasi preaching to me that he didn't care so much about all these external things because he had bhakti. And anyway, he obviously, well, he didn't do so well. So, we may think, well, bhakti is an internal thing. It's devotional. It's a feeling. It's something about the heart. It's not just about mechanical behavior. And yet, to think this way actually is very much, it would be sort of like the devotee way of expressing a popular dichotomy in modern culture, which is that people always say, well, I'm not religious, but I try to be spiritual. Or they'll say about someone else that they're not religious, but they're spiritual. And one friend of the movement, who was a great professor of religion in the 20th century, Houston Smith, wrote an article in which he expressed the danger of trying to take spirituality without religiosity. Now, we know that if someone simply tries to be very religious in the sense of very strict about this rule and that rule, but really doesn't have spiritual consciousness, really doesn't have compassion or love for other living beings, or you could say even for God, but it's more like it can become a vanity. One can become proud of one's austerities or one's practice, and so it becomes simply a source of pride. So history is full of stories of the hypocritical priest, you know, who's very strict but not spiritual and doesn't actually care about people. There are many stories like that in every tradition. But on the other side, there's a danger of being spiritual or claiming to be spiritual but not religious. Because taking spirituality to be an internal state, or a feeling, or a state of consciousness, if we cut it off from religiosity, taking religiosity to be observable behavior, then there's no check and balance. Someone can become degraded and degrading, in the sense of degrading other people, and at the same time claim to be spiritual because of some, je ne sais quoi, you know, because of some internal state. And so it really opens wide the doors of hypocrisy to separate. So really what Rupa Goswami is really getting at here in his verse, it really addresses the modern tension between religiosity and spirituality. Because Rupa Goswami is saying that you do have to be religious in the sense of you should try to follow certain principles, but at the same time, that by itself will not get you to heaven. Because the principles we follow, say like chanting, like coming to a class or kirtan and so on, these are opportunities to believe that just the act itself, regardless of the intention, is sufficient, is to buy into the karma mimamsa philosophy. Because the karma mimamsa philosophy is exactly that your intention, your consciousness is irrelevant. The power is in the ritual itself. The power is in the act itself, and you could literally just go to sleep, but as long as you do it, you know. I guess you could have on your headphones and be listening to, popular music, but as long as you say the right mantras and... So the idea that the power is in the act itself is a mechanical, it's actually impersonal, because it removes the real power or the center of focus from the person and the person's consciousness and the person's intention. And bhakti is all about that intention. For example, Arjuna was fighting at Kurukshetra, and so many other soldiers were fighting, but Arjuna's intention was pure bhakti. And therefore, he's Arjuna. It wasn't simply the act of fighting at Kurukshetra, it was the act of fighting at Kurukshetra with pure devotion for Krishna. So, but the good news here is, regarding bhakti, is that, to quote that famous example, or to cite the famous example from the Upanishads, there are two birds in a tree. One of them is the observing bird, the other one is the, I guess you call it the pig bird. The bird that's trying to enjoy the fruits of the tree. So Krishna is just watching us and just thinking, let me know when you're tired of being stupid. So any one of us, and like I said, it actually, externally, because we have different varnas and ashrams, we engage in different behavior externally. We follow different rules. Or we have different duties because based on varna and ashram. Varnashram dharma, so we have different dharmas. But there's ultimately, of course we do that, we should, you know, to a reasonable degree, follow our varnashram duties. But at the same time, there's sanatana dharma. Varnashram dharma is important, but it's not sanatana. It's not eternal. I'm not eternally a brahmana or a shudra, a kshatriya or vaishya, or a householder, or a brahmachari, or a sannyasi, or a vanaprastha. These are not eternal designations. In fact, the Bhagavatam warns us that if we begin to identify with these designations, it's simply another bodily concept of life. Maybe a little more, you know, a little fancier, little, you know, sort of a slick Vedic ignorance. It becomes the bodily concept of life. So if we we should take our varnashram duty seriously in the sense of if you're married, you have to be a good householder. If you're a sannyasi, you should be a good sannyasi or brahmachari, vanaprastha, whatever, or brahman and so on. But at the same time, we should remember that the real point is sanatana dharma. We have temporary dharmas for our temporary body, but we have eternal dharmas for our eternal soul. And on the level of sanatana dharma, everyone is equal. So, of course, if someone surrenders more to Krishna, that person becomes more Krishna conscious. But no one is closer to Krishna, no one is more dear to Krishna because of the kind of body they have. And to think they are is, it's simply ignorance. It's a kind of ignorance which is condemned in the Vaishnava literature. That means that any soul, any one of us, can choose through Sanatana Dharma, our ultimate Dharma, to surrender to Krishna and to become greatly empowered by Krishna to save this world. As I was saying the other day, it can't all depend on Bruce Willis, you know, to save the earth. We've also got to do our part. So that's the great freedom of Krishna consciousness. And here you see the example of Mother Yashoda. You see, this is not going to be a Bhagavatam class where he didn't speak about the verse. This is called a second half comeback. So, of course, we know that Mother Yashoda is a most exalted soul. And so as soon as we hear Yashoda, we hear Mother Yashoda, we think this is one of the greatest of all souls. However, for people who are not Krishna conscious and don't know the real value of things, Mother Yashoda, you could say, was not an impressive figure. After all, I'm not saying this as a fact, but from the point of view of an ignorant person, third class, Vaishya, a woman, oh my God. It's getting very serious. So here you have someone who, according to the ignorant, let's say the bodily concept of life, an ignorant concept of life, is not at all an important person. And yet it's Yashoda who captured Krishna. Actually, she's a most important person. She's a most exalted person. And she captured Krishna. Sometimes in the there's a verse in the ninth chapter of the Gita which is often misunderstood, where Krishna says that "Mam hi partha vipashritya yipi su papajani," whoever surrenders to me, even if they're of sinful birth or women, vaishas, shudras, and so on. Sometimes people think this is saying that women are of sinful birth or vaishas and shudras, which of course the verse is not saying. What Krishna is doing in this verse is not confirming prejudice and stereotypes, but he's actually refuting it and saying that people whom sometimes certain people consider to be lower actually are not lower. They can achieve the highest perfection. They have exactly the same opportunity. So that's what Krishna is saying. He's rejecting the idea that some people are automatically better because of their bodies. In fact, the Bhagavatam goes to great length to reject this and to show that this is nonsense. For example, as I often say, if you consider that Krishna was in this world for, what, about 125 years, and he must have done many, many, many amazing things every day. I mean, I don't think Krishna had off days. So if you multiply 125 times 365 times however many great things Krishna did every day, it's obvious he did tens and hundreds of thousands of amazing things during his stay here. And yet in the Bhagavatam, there's only a tiny, tiny fraction of everything Krishna did while in this world. What that means is that the pastimes that we find in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam and elsewhere have been highly selected. They've been highly selected. And Shuka Dev Goswami, for example, specifically wanted to bring out this tiny, tiny fraction of everything Krishna did because these things were so important to understand. And so one of those pastimes is that where Krishna sent his coward boys to beg for food from these high-class Brahmins who were clueless, and refused to give the food, and then the boys came back frustrated. Krishna sent them back and said, ask their wives, they're much more intelligent. So the boys went and asked the wives, and of course they were just sort of emptying out their pantries and bringing everything to Krishna. You know, they had all their little Vedic shopping baskets and everything, and so... So why did Sukadeva Goswami put that story in the Bhagavatam? To show that despite what is thought in the bodily concept of life, here is a case where the women were clearly much more intelligent than their husbands. The same thing is true in the story of Kali and Krishna. The same is, for example, we find at the Kurukshetra solar eclipse event, when it's amazing, which is actually the only time we read about where Krishna again saw the residents of Vrindavan. And what's interesting is that all the greatest kings in the world, these most aristocratic yadus, who were, you know, the most powerful, they were like gods on earth, literally, actually. So these super aristocratic, powerful, opulent people, and yet they were all offering their respects to the gopis. To the gopis, these cowherd maidens. And so these stories are placed there intentionally, because if we believe that ultimately a person's value is based on their body, then we are deeply in ignorance. In fact, the Bhagavatam says that archayam eva haraye pujam japsa dhyayate, a person who, with faith, undertakes to worship the deity, only worship the deity, nata bhakteshu, but does not worship that same deity in the heart of every living being. Especially in the devotees, but in every living being. In other words, the reason we come to the temple to see Krishna is because in the temple, the conditions have been maximized, optimized for Krishna consciousness. So everything that is humanly possible is done here so that we can be Krishna conscious. And therefore, this is the best place to come to be Krishna conscious. But the whole point is we are in sadhana bhakti. When we see the deity in this building, we are practicing so that we can walk out the door and see the same deity in the heart of every living being. So in order to actually be a transcendentalist and not just sort of a pious materialist, according to the Bhagavatam, one has to accept that every living body is actually a mandir. Every living body is a temple, because Krishna lives in it. And that's what the Bhagavatam says. And if one who sees Krishna only in the temple, deity, is described as prakrita bhakta, a materialistic devotee, a devotee on the material platform. So to actually be transcendental, to actually be spiritual, we practice here, because here it's here that Krishna makes himself most easily available, that Krishna openly reveals himself to everyone. And so we come, we see Krishna, and then we go out and we practice seeing Krishna in everyone we meet. And if we are really advancing, if we are actually advancing in Krishna consciousness, that we've not simply sort of drifted into a dull state where, yeah, this is my religion. I mean, it is our religion, but we actually have to be on the march. We're supposed to be moving. A movement can only be a group of people who are individually are moving. If all of us individually are sort of just, we've plateaued, we're at a cruising altitude, we're not really advancing, how can a bunch of people who are not moving be a movement? And ultimately, the real dynamic power of preaching, it doesn't come just from browbeating people or even like seducing them with, high cholesterol food. Ultimately, the ultimate secret of preaching is that we have to be literally sort of bubbling over with spiritual happiness. We have to be so happy, so thrilled with Krishna, with Prabhupada, with Prabhupada's mission, that we just have to tell other people. It's like we have to tell the world. Shout it from the rooftops. So it's really this spontaneous enthusiasm which spread the movement, because when Prabhupada was personally here, his purity, his obvious spiritual greatness enthused everyone so much that we just wanted to, drag people back to the temple. In fact, so much of the Prabhupada said, cool it. He didn't use that language, but Prabhupada used to write letters and say, don't be too eager to bring people into the ashram because, you know, some people weren't ready and Prabhupada could see that. But still, there's that extraordinary enthusiasm. And that has to come from our own personal advancement. We have to be... it's not that I was not these Back to Godhead articles, and of course we all love Back to Godhead, but it's not like I was searching for Krishna and then I found Krishna. I mean, that's true, of course, in a sense, but Prabhupada said, even the six Goswamis, the greatest Vaishnavas, they never said, now I found Krishna. They were asked, we know from the song, Hey Radhe, Hey Braja Devi, Kate, Salayite, Hey Nanda, Suno Kuta, Sri Govardhana, Kalpapada Patale, Kalindi Bane Kutaha, Goshanta Viti Saravato, Bajapure, Kedaya Mahabibalo, Mande Rupa Sanatana, Raguyugo, Sri Jiva Gopalabad. The six Goswamis were running. They were going everywhere in Vrindavan, Goshanta, crying out, where is Krishna? Where is Radha? So even they, Nitya Siddha devotees, were searching for Krishna. So Prabhupada has given us a perfect roadmap to find Krishna. But we have to be in the mood of searching for Krishna. When we come to the temple, we should be searching for Krishna, trying to surrender to Krishna, trying to take another step toward Krishna. So as Prabhupada said, he'll take 10 steps toward us. So that's the real point. Our life has to be progressive. We have to be mobilized. We have to be moving. We have to be trying to advance spiritually. And we have to be eager to bring other people along on this journey. So Prabhupada, on several occasions, Prabhupada, in not only, of course, many times in his classes, but also even in private conversations with me, he really opened his heart and revealed that that making this country Krishna conscious was the foundation of his global strategy. Prabhupada, as we know, on every level was brilliant, and he had a global strategy. And his strategy was to make this country Krishna conscious. So, that's our job. That's our job. Prabhupada always used to say that, he used to quote that verse where Krishna tells Arjuna, Nimitta Matram Bhava Sevyasachin. That Sevyasachi, lefty, actually Sevya means left, and Sachi means stretching the bow. So Arjuna stretched the bow his left hand. So Krishna told Arjuna, just be the instrument. Mayaivaite Nihata Purvameva. I alone have already killed all these enemies, all these warriors. You just be the instrument. Prabhupada would always say, Krishna is going to do this. Krishna is going to spread his movement. Now, if you want, you take the credit. You take the credit. So that when you leave this world, you can say to Prabhupada, I showed up. You know, it's like win, lose, or draw. We have to be detached from the fruits. And we can think like, who am I? How can I do it? I mean, if you think like, who am I? How can I change the world? Prabhupada used to always speak to this, and he used to say, don't think that you can't do it. Every one of us, according to Prabhupada's instructions, if you actually read them, every one of us is supposed to be a guru. And whether you become a Diksha guru, or a Shiksha guru, or a, you know, this kind of guru, or that kind, but the point is, everyone should be a teacher. Prabhupada's fear was that when he left, people would not become gurus. His followers would not be gurus. Because to be a teacher of Krishna consciousness means we all have to give up our selfish life. You know, there are sannyasi comfort zones, there are grihastha comfort zones, there are brahmachari comfort zones. You know, only those who are intelligent take up the sankirtan movement, so all of us have figured out how to be comfortable in our, you know, whatever situation we're in. There are definitely sannyasi comfort zones. It's sort of, you know, Pepto-Bismol intensive, but all of Mahaprasadam, but... So all of us, for Prabhupada, Prabhupada literally gave his life for us. We have to be prepared in mature, practical ways. Not, we don't have to become like, you know, crazy, enthusiastic people like we used to be, but we should show up for Prabhupada. We should say to Prabhupada that when you needed me, I was there for you. And we have to figure out how to actually make this movement relevant to Western people in the Western world. And that's a challenge for us now. And again, Maharaj showed his example. It doesn't matter. No one has a particular kind of body or a kind of varna or ashram that disqualifies you. Because it's really between you and Krishna in the heart. It's not about your body. It's about your relationship with Krishna in the heart. And anyone can surrender to Krishna and become the most dear devotee and the most empowered. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Yes.
Thank you, Marge. You were speaking about details and principles, and there's an obvious tension at this stage in the development of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, of ISKCON in the Western world, between what is a detail, what is a principle. So I was wondering if in the historical context, you could, you know, past and future, you could...
I would say that we should have a certain, what did Abraham Lincoln say? With, what was that? Malice toward none and charity for all? There are many different kinds of devotees in this world. And they have different psychologies, they have different cultures, they have different backgrounds, they have different spiritual and human needs. And different devotees are able to somehow find their way in Krishna consciousness through different, you know, you could say external or superficial, dressing this way, dressing that way, or whatever. I think the best course would be to sincerely honor and appreciate every sincere servant of Prabhupada, you know, however, I mean, sincere servant of Prabhupada, and then if we, as we do, believe that certain external methods may work better in the Western world, we should go out and try to demonstrate that by practical action. Yes, Sureshwar Prabhu. Sureshwar, by the way, is an old, very old friend of mine. And of course, as everyone knows, he is a wonderful Vaishnava. Can I tell that one little story from Boston?
I won't be able to ask my question.
Okay, well, go ahead, ask your question.
The way you were speaking about Gita 9:32, Mami Partha Vipashacha, it seems like the way it's translated in our books reinforces the misconception of the verse.
Okay, we could ask the question, is it our philosophy that someone that is born as a Vaishya is sinful? Prabhupada was born apparently in a Vaishya family. Or the residents of Vrindavan. Is Kunti sinful? Is Draupadi sinful? Is Radharani sinful? So this simple equation that women are sinful is just not there, and it's just not a Vedic principle.
So why do we translate it? O Sanapita, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, dash, and then lists all those people who are apparently of that Papa Yoni. Why is it translated like that? It reinforces the bodily concept.
I didn't edit the books. Don't kill the messenger. It's
But did that come from Srila Prabhupada? Or did it come...
Prabhupada, as we know from his practical activities, was most merciful to women. And actually, Prabhupada gave about many times multiplied the opportunities available to women in Lord Chaitanya's movement based on what was going on at the time in India. So, the word Papa generally means sin or sinful. So, Papa Yoni. Yoni means womb or source or, in that sense, birth. So, to say that all of humanity, except the relatively small number of Brahmins and kings, everyone is sinful, I think is really not the picture. The picture is that everyone who faithfully does their duty is respectable in Vedic culture. In fact, all the different varnas are located in the Rig Veda and in the Bhagavatam on the body of God. On the universal form of the Lord, we find the varnas and ashrams. So, of course, the demons are there too, sort of in the backside, but...
Well, the equalizer in that verse for me is Shudra, because Kalo Shudra Sambhava.
Yes.
So we're all...
Well, first of all, yeah, because Vaishyas and Shudras are about 99% of the men on the planet, or more. So really, for all practical purposes, it's everybody. It's everybody. Yes.
There's a tendency for people to rise to certain positions because of certain opulences that they have, generally speaking, you know. So on one level, ISKCON is an ecclesiastical organization. We have to respect, you know, anybody who's in a position of authority, gurus, sannyasis, temple presidents, temple commanders, etc. And how, my basic question is, how do you know whether a person's in a position because of a certain material designation that they have or ability, or spiritual?
I would say, Mayor, you have to see what your real purpose is. For example, let's say I'm driving and a policeman asks me to pull over. I'm not going to say, first tell me your motive, then I'll tell you if I'm going to pull over or not. I mean, there is such a thing as being a civilized human being and just following the rules. And Prabhupada made it very clear that he wanted us to be civilized and follow the rules. And then he said, but if you think something could be done better or is not being done right, then, you know, within the system, work for it. Actually, compared to many other religious organizations I've seen, ISKCON is very much an open, free society, to its great credit. Within reasonable boundaries, in my view, within reasonable boundaries, ISKCON, there's tremendous freedom in ISKCON. It's actually, in the old-fashioned, positive sense of the word, a liberal, open, free society, in which people can, you know, respectfully advocate points of view. So if someone's in a position because they have this quality or that quality, the real point is this person doing their duty appropriately, within reasonable standards? No one's perfect. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, every act has some fault, some imperfection. So within reasonable boundaries, is this person doing their duty? And if so, I don't think I really have to psychoanalyze them.
But how would you, if you were a person, a lay person in the organization,
yes,
how do you, what would be the mental state of viewing people who are, should you just think, well, they're totally, because when I was a younger devotee, I thought anyone in any position was empowered by Krishna. They were.
Well, to some extent they are. Yeah, we can't go from one extreme to the other. For example, Mukhya Prabhu, the president here, she invited me to come and give a class. And so I was honored by the invitation, and I wrote back and said I'd be happy to, and here I am. So somehow or other, Krishna has placed her there, and so I'm happy to cooperate. Obviously, I mean, you know, unless I'm personally managing, no manager can be perfect. And so, we all know. So, again, it's if we think there's a serious problem that someone somewhere in the world is, you know, engaged in serious malfeasance, seriously not doing their duty in a way that's really harming Prabhupada's mission, then of course we can go through proper channels and try to address it.
I wasn't really thinking of that in that vein. I was just thinking how to assess in general what is good association.
But that's not necessarily the same as someone in this or that position. We simply try to find like-minded devotees, people who encourage us and don't discourage us, and people whom we encourage and don't discourage. It's just, I think, you know, you just want to find a good friendship where you can engage in the loving exchange, as Rupa Goswami mentions.
Thank you very much.
Oh boy, he's grown. You've grown a lot. You with the microphone.
Very nice class, Maharaj. I was reading Sanatana Goswami's commentary on Vyad Vaishnava Tosini some time back. What you said was almost very identical. That he said that conception of Archayameva Hare Pujam, that, okay, you take the deity of the temple, then you go outside. But the agency of Kali might take advantage and say, you don't need to go to temple. God is everywhere. He's in the heart of the every soul. So why are you thinking of focusing on temple? And then again he says, you're not this body. So why are you torturing? Or fasting or all these rules, regulation, Ekadashi, this, that. So I say, Sanatana Goswami Pad gives a warning. There might be an agency of Kali temptates some people not to come to temple or follow, taking advantage of that two idea that you have expressed on the Archaima.
Yes. Yes, better.
Thank you very much for coming, Prahlacha. It's a pleasure to hear you again. My question for you is, you mentioned that Prabhupada wanted the United States to be the fourth leader in Krishna consciousness.
Wanted.
Prabhupada wanted the United States to be Krishna conscious, and therefore the world would follow. We know that the pure devotees do things in time and place. I'm not asking you to speculate, really. It's just your sort of personal
My inspiration at this point in my life is that Prabhupada made a wonderful offer, a most merciful offer to the Western people, that we, at least some of us, should try to deliver to the people, because Prabhupada made the offer and we have to deliver it to them. And the offer is that you can just add Krishna. You can just add Krishna. I think that we have to really consider whether we are getting that message across. Are we, there's like what you say and there's body language. So are we, is the message that we are conveying that you have to change everything about your life, the way you dress, the way you do everything? Obviously, I mean, some things have to change. For example, you have to follow the four principles. If you want to be a serious bhakti yogi, there's things you have to do. But are we really getting that, in the way we publicly present ourselves at festivals and Harinam, are we effectively communicating to people that they can just add Krishna? Or is our body language telling them that there are other things you have to do besides just adding Krishna to your life? So that's, again, Prabhupada said that there are so many wonderful things in America, but they are zeros without Krishna. But if you put the one of Krishna in front of it, it becomes a big number. Are we trying to convince people in our, to be honest, Festival of India, are we trying to convince people that take out the Western zeros, bring in zeros from another place, and then put the one up? Because that's like three times as much work. If you think about it, and you know, lazy intelligence is a wonderful thing. It's immediately bonded with that concept. So, because if you just put the one up in front of the zeros, you get the huge number. If you take the zeros out, bring new zeros in, then put the one up, that's three times as much work. And it's just, I don't think it's going to happen. So basically, I think we have to find a way to make that amazing offer that Prabhupada made, to convey it to people and really make it available to them as a living option, not just as an idea, as words, but as something you can really do. You can really just add Krishna in your life. And I think if we focus on trying to add Krishna to the Western world, rather than dragging the Western world over to a different external culture, it's going to be a lot easier. And I think ultimately, as a someone who has, you know, studied history and all that, if it would work, if we could actually like drag the whole country over to a different ethnic tradition, I'd say do it. But my study of history leads me to believe, as an individual, I'm not saying this is an absolute truth, it's just my view that this is never going to happen. It's not happening now, it will not happen in the future. I think what is possible, and what Prabhupada said we could do, is to take the West and add Krishna. Add Krishna's perfect knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita, add the supreme process of Bhakti Yoga under the leadership of Krishna's most dear devotee, Prabhupada. I think if we focus on adding Krishna to the good things that are out there, because in America, like everywhere else, there are three modes of nature.
some, I mean, obviously many things in India are more Vedic and some things in America are much more Vedic. Public order is extremely Vedic. You know, public officials doing their duty without bribes is Vedic. Keeping public places clean and tidy is Vedic. So there are all kinds of Vedic things that you find. Ultimately, I think something good for ISKCON, because undoubtedly you will attract certain people in a certain way. Other people may be attracted in a different way, but we're both trying to bring them to Prabhupada into the same in Prabhupada's ISKCON. So the fact that we put some more items on the menu only will make the restaurant more popular. So that, I mean, I really want to make that point that I do respect, and more than respect, actually. I admire the devotees who are sincerely trying to do it in the way that you're describing. And I wouldn't question your devotion to Prabhupada. And so ultimately what I'm saying is simply that I'd like to try, if I could, to put another item on the menu. And to see what happens, you know, maybe nothing, maybe something good will happen. Actually, I have to get to a plane. Yes?
Yes, that's an ongoing conversation, isn't it? Actually, what I was thinking more when I asked the question was that we're seeing so much progress in other countries, Russia, or some of the Slavic countries. They seem to be sparking very quickly about Krishna consciousness. And if Prabhupada were here, he would be seeing that. And would he, that one idea was, would he then shift? Well, yes, if Russia becomes Krishna conscious, the world can become Krishna conscious.
I think that really is more about the geopolitical situation than the ISKCON situation. When Prabhupada said that he wanted America to become Krishna conscious, it wasn't based on anything that had ever yet happened in America. It was based on America's position in the world.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. That has so much.
So Russia has actually become less important in the world, not more important, but it's still an important country. Anyway, thank you all very much. And again, I have the greatest admiration for everyone who's trying to serve Prabhupada, and we're just going to see if we can help. That's all.